Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Continue our study in personalities of the New Testament. Today we're going to be with Aquila and Priscilla, a very interesting couple that Paul meets and is very helpful to him. We dealt with them somewhat when we dealt with Apollos because they were very influential in the life and teaching ministry of Apollos. They were the ones who really informed him on the fullness of the gospel. If you have your Bibles, I hope you'll turn to Acts chapter 18. We'll look first at verses 1 through 4, and in the second half of the program, we'll deal with some verses later in the chapter. This word says, "But after this, he left Athens and went to Corinth." Now, we're speaking about Paul here. Athens was a very difficult time for the Apostle Paul. Athens was an intellectual center. It was had great history. The Greeks were very proud of their ancient philosophers. And Paul, seeing a statue to an unknown god, you might want to read chapter 17 to set the stage for his attitude the time he meets Priscilla and Aquila in Corinth. But it was a very hard time, a time that really changed his presentation of the gospel. Matter of fact, if you'll turn over in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 2, I'd like to read just a couple of verses there, I think, that really show me exactly what happened to Paul. Listen to what it says. "And when I came to you, brothers, I did not come to tell you God's uncovered secrets in rhetorical language or human philosophy. For I determined while among you to be unconscious of everything but Jesus Christ and him crucified. Yes, as for myself, I was in weakness and fear and great trembling that I came to you, and my language and message I preached were not adorned with pleasing words of worldly wisdom, but they were attended with proof and power given by the Holy Spirit, so that your faith might not be in man's wisdom, but in God's power." Paul had apparently given up his intellectual approach to the gospel. He tried that in Athens. He had the ability to do that from his rabbinical training, his background, intellectual center like Tarsus. But he realized that intellectual arguments don't bring people to Jesus. And so he changed his style and began to simply proclaim the message of Christ crucified. Also, Paul, and I think it's important we realize, from Athens in his bold proclamation that had no effect, to a more humble stance at Corinth, really underwent some changes. Many of us believe that this time is when his thorn in the flesh became more evident for him. Many believe it's malaria. I personally believe it was oriental eye problem known as ophthalma, which caused his eyes to protrude and difficulty in seeing. But anyway, it was a hard time for Paul. Paul was only 50 miles from Athens to Corinth, but what a change happened in the manner of his presentation of the gospel. And instead of being confident, bold, he came to Corinth in weakness, trembling, great fear, he said. So quite a difference happened. Now, Corinth was a very unusual city. It was a very large city. Some estimate between 600,000 if you include both the port cities on either side of the isthmus. Corinth was destroyed in 146 B.C. by the Roman army because of their arrogance, and it stayed desolate for years and years, and Julius Caesar had it rebuilt. Now, there's some doubt if he rebuilt the temple to Aphrodite up on the Acrocorinthus, which is the hill above the city. But anyway, it was a city known for its lasciviousness, its wickedness. Matter of fact, the term Corinthian became a nickname for wickedness and prostitution and that kind of thing. It was a real port city. The world met in Corinth. It was a city that was known for the Isthmus Games, the Olympiad that was carried on there. It was a city that ships came in there all the time because it was dangerous to go around the islands of Greece to get to Rome. But there was a narrow isthmus there of about 4 to 5 miles. Nero tried to cut a channel through, but just didn't work. And what they would do is, the small ships, they would roll them across that isthmus on logs. If it was large ships, they would unload them and relocate them on the other side. And so Corinth was a very important city. The chief deity of this city was Poseidon, as you can imagine, the god of the sea. But Aphrodite was a very important deity here. It was the capital of Achaia. Now, let's look a little further. There he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus. Now, Pontus is on the Black Sea. In the second century, there's another person named Aquila from this same area who made a very literal translation of the Hebrew But there's no relationship here. Now, Aquila is a name that means eagle. Priscilla is his wife. The name in Roman means little old lady. What a name to have, little old lady. Well, this is a place we learned that Aquila was Jewish, but Priscilla, his wife, is never mentioned as Jewish. You see her mentioned in the next little phrase. Four times out of the six that this couple is mentioned in the Bible, Priscilla occurs first. Let me tell you where. Acts 18:18, Acts 18:26, Romans 16:3, and 2 Timothy 4:19. Now, there's many theories for this. Some think she was the dominant personality. Matter of fact, many people have believed that she was the author of the book of Hebrews. Well, they think Apollos is also the author, and Barnabas is also the author, and on it goes. But we don't know who the author of Hebrews is, but she's put forward as one possibility. Many people have assumed that her name, her Roman name, is Prisca. Now, you'll find in Acts that Luke uses the more familiar names of people, like Silas, where Paul calls him Silvanus, and he calls her Priscilla, while Paul would call her Prisca. Now, Prisca is a Roman family name. Many people surmise that she was a high-born noble woman, a Roman, but that she met this Jewish tent maker and fell in love with him. Well, that's a pretty good love story. It's as good as the world turns, I guess. We just don't know. But for some reason, she is mentioned first several times. Now, it mentions that they had to leave Rome, and it says, because Claudius had issued an edict that all the Jews to leave Rome. Now, there is some divergence of opinion among Roman historians as to this particular account. We learn from three different sources. I hope you get the weekly outline of our lesson, and I'll list all the sources in there. But three basic ones. We learn about the edict itself from the life of Claudius 25:4, where it mentions that he sent all the Jews out of Rome because of a riot that occurred in the Jewish ghetto because of a man named Christus. Now, it's spelled a little different from Christos, which is the Greek name for Christ, but they would be pronounced the same in the Greek tongue. And for a Roman who was hard to pronounce other countries' names, many of us believe this Christus is nothing less than Christ. Because, you know, it's never mentioned about the salvation of Aquila and Priscilla. So it's assumed they are already believers, which gives great credence to the fact that the Roman church was started many, many years before the Apostle Paul got there. And so that seems to add weight. Now, Claudius reigned from 41 to 54 A.D. We learn the date from a Jewish historian, and I'll spell the name because I'm not sure how you pronounce it, O-R-O-S-I-U-S, in his histories, at volume 7, chapter 6, 15. And then we learn from him it was A.D. 49. But another Roman historian, Dio Cassius, in his histories, mentions that it really wasn't an edict that forced the Jews to leave Rome, but it was an edict that banned them from their ancestral customs, which in effect caused them to leave. But there is some discrepancy over the accounts. There is much knowledge that is lacking in this period of Roman histories, and we just have to live with that. Now, notice what it mentions, that so Paul paid them a visit, as they all had the same trade. Now, Paul was a tent maker, and I want to talk about that some, because more and more scholarship is trying to say he was a worker of leather. Now, this comes probably from two reasons. The word in Greek used tent maker can mean leather worker. Some tents were made out of leather, other made out of woven fabric. The place where Paul was from, Cilicia, was famous for the material from the goats there. Skin was important, but also the woven fabric. Now, my understanding of rabbinical Judaism is that every rabbi had to have a secular trade. Gamaliel III said it was absolutely terrible for a rabbi to make his living from teaching the law. They had to have a secular trade that kept them involved with the common people and know what work was like. So Paul would have been taught a trade, some trade as a rabbi. Because he comes from an area where goat skin as well as woven material was very important, Cilicium. It's probable that that's what he did. But you see, for a Jewish rabbi to work with the dead skins of animals would have made him ceremonially unclean. That's why when Peter visited the house of Simon the Tanner, it would have made Peter in the earlier account of Cornelius and the vision up on the roof, unclean. So I really don't think leather work would fit for a rabbi. I do think that probably Aquila and Priscilla and Paul worked with different woven materials to make tents. And it was a common trade, apparently, for Jewish people. Now, and they proceeded to work together. Every Sabbath, it was Paul's habit to preach in the synagogue and to persuade both Jews and Greeks. Now, every Sabbath tells us that as a regular practice of Paul's life, he attended the synagogue in the town that he was in for two reasons. One, I'm sure it was just one of his habits. You know, there's many, I guess one of the hardest things as a pastor is to go back through your church like a pictorial directory and see the number of people that have dropped out of the church, have got mad or just quit coming. And it's so easy to get out of the habit, say, of church attendance or tithing or visitation or witnessing. Many times, habits that we develop become tremendous helps to us, guidelines, motivators. Sometimes we do things because we've done them when we don't feel like doing them. And when they're in the area of positive religious habits, they are very helpful. Paul here had his regular pattern of his life, attended the synagogue when he could on the Sabbath. And he proclaimed to these Jews, the Western text adds about Jesus Christ, but doesn't mention that here, but he talked to them about Christ, and he talked to Jews and Greeks. Now, why would a Greek be in a synagogue? Well, these are a particular kind of Greeks known as God-fearers. Now, they're not proselytes of the gate because that involved circumcision and baptism. But many, many Greeks were attracted to the monotheism of Judaism, to the high ethical standards of Judaism, and they would attend the synagogue, like Cornelius, keep some of the rules, but were not official members of the synagogue. Now, I think it's extremely important that we see that he came for the purpose of sharing with these Greeks and getting a foothold in these particular areas, as well as trying to talk to the Jewish people about the background of the Old Testament, where they found Christ in certain Old Testament prophecies. Isaiah was a very important part. Many of the prophets. Remember the last few days of Jesus' life. He was involved in showing where he himself has found the Old Testament as the two on the road to Emmaus. And that apparently is what Paul did in the synagogue. Well, before I get to the next section later, here's my friend to offer some opportunities for you.
Thank you for watching today. Bob will return in just a moment. We at the International Sunday School Lesson would like to take this opportunity to offer you a weekly exegetical outline of these Sunday School lessons free. This includes historical background, word and phrase study, and discussion questions. All we need is your address. Now, here is ours. International Sunday School Lesson Incorporated, Post Office Box 2711, Lubbock, Texas, 79408. Also, there is available free and postage paid the catalog of Bob's teachings on cassette tapes. This catalog includes over 900 subjects. We will be happy to send it to you this week so that you can order the tapes that interest you. Now, here is our address again. International Sunday School Lesson Incorporated, Post Office Box 2711, Lubbock, Texas, 79408.
Thank you. I hope you'll send for that outline. I think it'll be helpful to you in providing the background study to the words, the parallel passages, and when I get to these Roman historians, I'll fill them in for you, the names and the titles of their book, where you can find these prime source materials. Now, let's look at verses 18 down through, about 22, which picks up on Priscilla and Aquila again. Now, Paul stayed a considerable time in Corinth. Now, Paul majored in two cities because of their geographical significance. One of them was the city of Ephesus, where he spent over 2 years, which, because of the geographical location and the influence of Ephesus, affected all of Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. Corinth was also a very important city because all the world met there. Not only did it have a geographical significance for Greece, but it also touched many people's lives going to other parts of the empire. Rome and Antioch were also important cities, but it seems that Ephesus and Corinth played the most important part as strategic centers in the ministries of Paul. Now, He bade the brothers goodbye and set sail for Syria. Now, of course, when it says Syria, he's going to Antioch. Antioch had become the leading city of Christendom, especially the Gentile mission. Jerusalem was still very Jewish in its orientation and had not really caught the vision, the world vision of the message of Jesus. Accompanied by Aquila and Priscilla, Paul took them from Corinth and took them back to Ephesus. And we know they stayed in Ephesus a long time. We're going to find them back in Rome in Romans 16:3. Apparently after the death of Claudius in A.D. 54, they returned to Rome. Now, where they, Priscilla and Aquila, set up different shops, like in Rome and Corinth and Ephesus, and had people work for them, or whether they just picked up their business and changed locations.
Three.
What I consider to be full-time Christians, wherever they are. It's my particular theory that the New Testament makes no distinction between clergy and laity. We do different things for a vocation, but as far as a lifestyle, we are all full-time Christians. And Priscilla and Aquila let their vocation, tent-making, serve their ministry. And so whatever involved with the work of their ministry, they changed locations. And I think that's true of the entire New Testament pattern. Now, when it says, at Cenchrea, he had his hair cut, for he was under a Nazarite vow. The Latin Vulgate and one North African translation has Aquila. Now, grammatically, it is possible that it could relate to Aquila, but the whole context through here is emphasizing, of course, the ministry of Paul, and it seems to refer to Paul. Now, Cenchrea is the eastern port city of Corinth. We learn about it from Romans 16:1 in the ministry of a deaconess named Phoebe. It might surprise you about deaconesses in the New Testament because many people have preconceived notions and have their minds made up on this issue. I personally believe the Bible does talk about deaconesses, and Phoebe in Romans 16:1 is one of them. Also, in 1 Timothy 3, it lists the qualification of pastors and deacons, and it has the feminine pronoun there. King James translates it deacon's wives, but that's totally inappropriate. It means, I think it's deaconesses there too. I really feel like that the deaconesses mentioned are synonymous with the widow's role, which means women over 60 whose husband has died. But anyway, that's, Cenchrea plays a significant part, not only in Priscilla and Aquila and Paul, but in Phoebe. Now, this deal about you having your hair shaved, if you want to look in the Old Testament for that, it's Numbers 6, 1 through 21, which talks about a Nazarite vow. Now, Samson was a Nazarite. John the Baptist was a Nazarite. It was a special commitment to God whereby one did not cut their hair. One did not drink anything that came from the vine. It also involved, in later Judaism, no eating of meat. The cutting of the hair by Paul's day in the particular customs of rabbinical Judaism meant that the vow was over, not that it was beginning. Now, why Paul continued to burden himself with Jewish rites is a question that we really can't answer. Paul was very sensitive to become all things to all men that he might win some. And whether he was still trying by this measure to somehow identify some way with the Jews in Achaia and Macedonia, we just do not know. Maybe it was a personal commitment to God about his ministry at Corinth. You know, Paul was still Jewish in his background, and maybe his personal devotion issued in Jewish rites. We just do not know. But apparently it was Paul who had cut his hair as a sign that his Nazarite vow was finished. In verse 19 it mentions, and they came to Ephesus, and Paul left them there. Now, Ephesus was the place that Paul spent 2 years plus of his life. Priscilla and Aquila, I'm sure, were trusted missionary companions, and there was a work for them to do there is why Paul took them with him from Corinth to Ephesus. And Paul left them there, and he went into the synagogue and had a discussion with the Jews. Now, again, Paul tried everywhere he went to influence the Jewish people first. I think Paul, because he was faithful to the words of Christ, and Jesus over and over says, I come to the Jews first and then also the Greeks, in the book of Romans, Paul mentions that several times. I think he felt a responsibility to go to the house of Israel first. And then when they rejected, he went to the Gentiles. And so he follows that pattern throughout his journeys in Acts. And here we have him coming back and touching base with the Jewish people of Ephesus. Now, notice again, it mentions in verse 20, and they asked him to stay longer, but he would not consent. Now, the reason probably is that Paul, we learn, was on his way to the Passover in Jerusalem. Sailing in the ancient world was very precarious in good weather, much less in bad weather. And there are particular parts of the year where a person could not sail. The overland journey was dangerous because of robbers. It was because of the lack of accommodations. A very hard trip, and usually people took a ship when they could. Now, Paul wanted to go to the Passover. It seems when we look back historically, the Passover occurred in May of this particular year, in this particular time. And you could not really sail in these waters after March. So Paul was in a hurry to get back to Antioch so he could go on to Jerusalem. We think he landed at Caesarea. Now, that would mean that he was in a hurry. The Jews, and I'm sure also the Christians there, the believers, wanted Paul to stay, wanted him to teach them more, wanted more time with him. But Paul was in a very great hurry, and he went on to Jerusalem. Now, why he left Priscilla and Aquila is uncertain. They were also, at least Aquila was a Jew for sure, and I'm sure he would have enjoyed a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. But these were more missionary workers than they were vacationers, and they knew that apparently their place was in Ephesus to help build up the church there than to go with Paul to Jerusalem. Now, it continues then, verse 21, but he bade them goodbye, and he promised, I will come back to you again if it is God's will. You know, I've heard many times people say, well, I'll be there if the creeks don't rise and if the Lord's willing. Well, creeks or no creeks, I think sometimes we use that little thing as a slang saying, you know, it's the Lord's will. But Paul and the New Testament are very sincere about that. In the book of James, it talks about if it's God's will, we'll do this or that, not that we can plan our lives. I think we need to live in a daily awareness that our lives are not our own. When we come to Jesus Christ, we lay our lives symbolically on the altar of his service. And then our lives are not what we decide to do. We do not make decisions in what's best for us. We do not guide things in what we are inclined to do. We must seek God's will about every area of our life. And when we do that, when we take the time to really search that out, God's not going to speak to us audibly. He's not going to give us a road map. But I think we need to be sensitive that our lives, our travels, our priorities, our emphasis, all of that, that God does have a will for us. Paul was sensitive to that. He realized it. Then he set sail from Ephesus. When he reached Caesarea, now there's two Caesareas in the Bible. There's Caesarea Philippi, that's north of the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus went and where Peter's confession was made. But there's another Caesarea known as Caesarea by the Sea, which was the military Roman military headquarters in Palestine. There's no natural port on the Palestinian coast, and so the Romans had to build a port, and Caesarea was it. When he went up to Jerusalem, now, of course, in rabbis talked about always going up to Jerusalem. There were some higher geographical places in the land of Israel, but theologically, you always went up to Jerusalem, and so they always used that, no matter which direction they were coming from. And greeted the church there. Then he went down to Antioch. And, of course, notice, if you look at a map, it's not down to Antioch. It's up to Antioch. But, again, it's that theological inference. Now, I think it's interesting here. the Western text adds something. You have King James, you'll see it, that he wanted to be there for the festival. Now, I want to stop a minute about textual criticism. I think it confuses people. They feel like we're taking away from the Bible when we say that something is an addition. I want to know, as best I can, the actual words of Luke and the apostles and Jesus. Many times, as you know, the Bible, there was no printing press then. They were copied by hand. Someone would dictate and many would copy, became a normal thing. And these copiers were trying to help the people who they knew to understand the text. And so they would add notes in the margin about this or that or explaining this. But the next guy to copy it would just read that note, and the copyist would put it in the text. The manuscripts that the King James Bible is based on are known as the Byzantine family or the Western family or the many times the Bizet manuscript is picked out. It's known as Manuscript D. It is a later manuscript of the 6th century A.D. It adds many, many extra notes to our Bible. I think they're helpful, in, like Paul was going for the festival. That's probably what he was going for. But even though they're helpful and probable, we want to get back to the words of Luke. I've done a tape on that called Textual Criticism, and I've used part of the book of Jude to, as an example. If you would like to know a little bit more about textual criticism, I hope you'll write for that tape. I'll send it to you free. Also, there's two good books I want to mention. The Books and the Parchments by F.F. Bruce will help you understand how you got the English Bible that sits in your lap. The first volume of the 3-volume History of the Church by Oxford Press, the first volume, will help you get great insight into how you got the English Bible and all these different families of manuscripts. And third, if you're real interested in this and want a more technical book, the book by Metzger on New Testament criticism will be very helpful to you. I've enjoyed being with you.